I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's a marvelous book out called Vanishing Vancouver, The Last 25 Years. Its author, Michael Kluckner, joins me now. I've long been a fan of his books. They're generously illustrated with Mr. Kluckner's own watercolors, as well as with photographs. The book is a wonderful narrative of his own observations about Vancouver, its changing landscape, thanks to the buildings either being demolished or adapted. The original Vanishing Vancouver was published in 1990 and went up to Expo 86. This one takes up the story of that book and takes us through to the recent past. We see Vancouver change, and I'll ask Mr. Kluckner if it has for the better or not, where he sees Vancouver going, and we'll discuss some of the observations made in this very fine book. Michael Kluckner is an artist and writer who has spent more than two decades recording and interpreting histories and landscapes of the city, province, and country. He was the founding president of the Heritage Vancouver Society. He's written well over a dozen books. He is a forthcoming director of the Vancouver Historical Society, of which I'm a non-participating member. Incidentally, Mr. Kluckner is speaking at the May 24th meeting of the Historical Society at the Museum of Vancouver. That's 7:30 p.m. next Thursday. He'll be talking about this book. The website for more is at michaelkluckner.com. The book is published by Whitecap. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Michael Kluckner. Mr. Kluckner, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So over the last few years, my understanding is that you lived in the valley for a spell and then overseas, right?
Yeah, we were. We decided to go farming in the early 1990s and raise sheep and so on a small farm out in the Fraser Valley, and then moved to Australia and for about 3.5 years, and then came back to Vancouver just as the Winter Olympics were starting, and we decided to move back and settle here. And so after some some kind of shopping around for places and living in a number of furnished apartments, the kind of short-term rentals that you can get off Craigslist, that type of thing, we found a very beaten-up 100-year-old house over in Grandview and bought it and set to work restoring it. So that kind of got us back into the neighborhood and thinking about the changes in Vancouver.
And had you lived prior to coming back? Had you lived in different parts of the city?
We sort of ex-Kitsilano hippies, I guess, and from 60s, 70s, and then moved from Kitsilano to Kerrisdale in the early 80s, when Kerrisdale was a very different place from the way it is now. I had a little house there with a garden, and then moved to the farm in the valley after that.
Yeah. When you came back this last time that you did, I guess this was around the Olympics, right? Or just
mm-hmm.
before the Olympics. What surprised you about how the city looked?
Well, I think it was the condo towers had been going on for a while, and not actually living in the city, I had been aware of the way that this huge forest of them had grown. But it was partly, I think, what had changed was this attitude, the way that the condo lifestyle, the strata title lifestyle, had been sold to people, and I found that really interesting, how intense that was. It was almost to the point of eliminating any other possibility from people's consciousness of what it meant to be a Vancouverite, and that was a real contrast with Sydney, Australia, where much more of a mix of types of housing and people's attitudes towards themselves and their cities. And so I was surprised by that. The other thing that really jumped out at me, though, was when we were in kind of looking around in the old neighborhoods, looking for a place where we could settle. And the way that the old neighborhoods had been reinvented by typically by young couples. I mean, by young, I'm saying people in their 30s and their 40s who were moving in. They were fixing up the old houses. They were painting them out. They were gardening them right out to the curbs. There was a lot more vegetable gardening going on. The streets seemed to be lively, and this is in that kind of streetcar suburb part of Vancouver, which seemed very different from the glass and steel downtown. And I loved the contrast. The kind of contrast and complement of those two aspects of the city. And to be honest, I don't think it never worked that well in the past. It was really very good.
So what do you think happened in the interim? What do you think changed?
Well, I think that the city had the opportunity in the 20 years of, we were gone from the city effectively for about 18 years, but the city really picked up on the opportunity of redeveloping its brownfield sites, as they call them, the old downtown south area that was pretty derelict. It was, auto repair shops and second-rate nightclubs mainly.
Sort of like Marine and Kent area down there?
Well, I wasn't thinking of so much down there. I was thinking of the areas around False Creek, Yale Town.
I see.
And directly south of the commercial downtown. And then continuing on into the southeast False Creek area, although the Olympic Village was, had become an issue that I had been following when we were away, still in Australia. But that really got underway, and it repopulated the downtown in a very successful way. But there were the debates that were already well underway about the merit of the architecture, about whether that type of high-rise condo was really how you build a city, and whether these buildings themselves would be adaptable to the future, and whether indeed even they would last, or whether they would be a new version of the leaky condos of the 1980s, and people will remember them as being, mainly the kind of low-rise buildings that were rotting from within and leaking from outside, very poorly built buildings, the sort of thing tarped up that was typical Vancouver.
You mentioned earlier this idea about what it means to be a Vancouverite, that we don't seem to have that sort of idea in our consciousness, that most people in the city don't. One would think that that's the preserve of the civic-minded, and if we look at, people's participation in democracy, they're not really participating. So how important is it that we need to think about not just living here, working here, but what it means to be a Vancouverite?
Well, to me it's very important. I mean, I'm probably deeper into it than most people, but I find with my neighbors and the people we come in contact that, they have their own individual sense, and it depends partly on where they are in their lives, and partly also on economics, of course, because the affordability thing is huge now compared.
Yeah.
It's something that never really goes away in Vancouver. People have been saying that Vancouver is unaffordable since the 1960s. I think it's just that way that the people look at the way they live their lives at different stages of it. And whether you're the type of Vancouverite who, takes your iPad to the coffee shop and spends a whole day there and meets up with friends, or whether you're somebody who walks on the seawall, or somebody who tends your garden, I think there's a different kind of ethos about the city maybe than you would find in a place like a Toronto or a Montreal. People just having this sense, and what I find very positive about Vancouver and moving back is the number of people who have adopted the old wooden houses and said, this is the way that we want to live, and the small apartments around areas like the Drive, even Fourth Avenue, although that's gone terribly upscale, Main Street, the Mount Pleasant area, how much people really identify with that, and they say, my lifestyle involves this kind of house, this relationship with my neighbors, my ability to walk to a bus, to a train, that type of thing.
How much of what you do in these books that you write and illustrate is to make sure that they last dozens of years, decades later, so that we have a record? I mean, are you motivated by that when you write these books?
Yeah, I'm a kind of like a moth flying towards a candle flame. I can't stop myself from trying to remember places that are going to be torn down, and particularly the ones that I think are being torn down to be replaced by something that is not an improvement. I'm not necessarily just talking about architecture. I'm talking about the whole matter of sustainability and neighborhood character and values and the layers of history on the landscape. And I'm really very involved in that. There was a book, it was a different kind of a, you know, split between city and country in North America, Australia too, where the cities are these very dynamic places of change. And so you expect that there's going to be change, and you expect that places are going to be threatened, and you're going to have to fight to try to keep some of them. But cities do have the resources to be able to manage that kind of change. And the thing I couldn't abide if it were to happen in Vancouver would be to have this city go the way of a place like Singapore, where they just, it's just clear cut and it's all new. And this is what it looked like Vancouver was going to be like in the 1960s.
So what are some of the resources that we have? I mean, in terms of heritage designation, is that I guess that's one of them, right?
Yeah, well, the heritage designation is one part of it. You know, just the wealth that is created in the city allows the city to zone in particular ways to help owners out. I mean, even in the on a relatively modest scale, the Vancouver Heritage Foundation is able to raise enough money to give some grants to help people paint houses, fix them up if the houses are, you know, of a kind of a historic character. But when you get out in the country, the subject of the book Vanishing British Columbia, which I did a number of years ago before we moved to Australia, you're in this situation where the countryside is depopulating and places are abandoned because nobody wants to live there anymore. People are moving to the cities for jobs. And so in that case, there's a real recording of these dots on the landscape that are going to disappear one way or another because there's really no use for them. In the city, it's way more complex than that. But if you listen to some of the people, the proponents of change and development in the city, they would say, well, in order to be green or sustainable or otherwise, you know, we got to tear all this stuff down and build new things that are greener. And I mean, I just point out and quote people from all over the place that we have to reuse buildings. We have to keep these old places alive and adapt them if we want to have any legitimate chance at all of being considered a green place. Demolition and new construction is very rarely a green solution to anything at all.
Well, let's talk about maybe a couple buildings that have been reused. Wednesday night I was inside the Stanley Theatre for a show. That's an example of something. I mean, I guess you were involved in that, weren't you, in the early?
Yeah, back in 1991, 1992. The funny thing was with the Stanley that the facade of it was on the city heritage inventory, but as far as the city was concerned at that time, what went on behind the facade, the actual use of the building, was not something that the city was interested in. They had this idea that heritage was just architecture, not use. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in, the kind of heritage activist community, but also people who in the film, film groups and enthusiasts and so on, thought completely differently. And so there was a big campaign to save the Stanley as a performance space. And that went on. It took a few years to do. And it took the city using its kind of grab bag of tricks of transferring density off the site and selling it to a downtown office building so that the downtown office building could become taller than it would otherwise have been. Then that money flowed back into the Stanley, and it ended up being restored as a beautiful theater. It's very hard to imagine that South Granville part of Vancouver without the cultural hub that the Stanley presents. But if it had gone the way that the city wanted to 20 years ago, it would have been a shopping mall. Mm. And it would have had the facade. You would have gone in through the doors, and there would have been probably 10 little shops in there, you know, selling what?
Yeah. Now you mentioned the scheme that the city has, where you can transfer density from one part of the city to another. For people living outside of Vancouver, listening to this, is this something unique to Vancouver, or do other cities adopt that sort of scheme?
I think Victoria is trying to get into it, but others don't. It's something that came up in Vancouver. beginning way, way back, actually, with the saving of Christchurch Cathedral in the mid-1970s. As is typical with some church congregations, that they're in the business of saving souls, not saving buildings. And, you know, this is the way that they would look at it anyhow. And with the Christchurch congregation at that time, they thought that if they demolished the cathedral and then built an office tower on the site with a smaller church, a kind of a crypt down below, that development would give them enough money to do the all of the good works that they wanted to do in the community, you know. And I mean, you think about it in the abstract, you think it's not that bad an argument, but the wider community went nuts and they rethought the thing. It would have been, interestingly, it was Arthur Erickson whose design would have been done of the office tower on the site. But anyway, the community thought better of it, and the city began to look at ways that it could deal with this. And what ended up happening was that the office tower just to the north of it, Park Place, it grew taller with the density that would otherwise have been built on the Christchurch site. And the owners of the Park Place office building make a payment every year in perpetuity to Christchurch Cathedral that allows them to maintain the old church and then do the outreach programs that they wanted. And so that was where the thing began. And then it got into a kind of a horse trading thing that got way out of hand in the early 2000s, kind of mid-2000s. And particularly there were three big projects. The one that everybody would know about would be the Woodwards project. Right. Anybody who knows Vancouver. What surprised me so much when I moved back to Vancouver and I saw this thing was that the developers of Woodwards had received this huge heritage bonus, and all they had really saved was two walls of the original part of the building. There's really no conservation there at all. And yet they were given this big density transfer that they were, in theory, able to sell. And what it's done is it's just frozen the system up completely.
Yeah. Whose fault is that? The politicians, do you think?
Certainly in that case, because the politicians approved the rezoning and the density transfer. And they say, if you're going to give somebody a heritage bonus, if you're going to use that system, you actually have to save something. It isn't enough to save the idea of Woodwards to put posters up and say on the site, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, particularly if you're trying, when you roll that into the desire of the city to be Greenest City 2020, you don't become Greenest City by demolishing a reusable building. I mean, it's just the energy costs in that is just astonishing.
How have politicians in the city from Larry Campbell onwards through Sullivan and now the current mayor, Robertson, do you think they're subscribing to what you think or not?
Well, no, and they would argue, each one is different, but of the current group of Gregor Robertson and the Vision Council, they see their priorities as being broader than... You know, I think back in the 90s, the heritage was pretty well up there near the top of what council wanted to do when it was kind of trying to direct development in the city. But the current group, they've got rental housing huge on their agenda. Affordability, of course, I guess affordable housing, period, is there. And they've also taken to using this ability to that they have to rezone a property and then to exact a fee from the developers. This is what people saw on that Rise development in Mount Pleasant that was very recently in the news, and then before that, the Shannon News development in South Carisdale. And you know, so what they're doing is they're giving all this density to developers in return for these community amenity contributions that are then going to pay for things in the community, whether they're, I don't know, you know, art galleries or community center type of thing, the sort of thing that used to be done on capital improvement bylaws in capital plans at election time. And, they still are, they're paying more than lip service to to heritage. I mean, they're still supporting it, but I just don't think it's a priority that it used to be.
Now, one of the things that in this book, Vanishing Vancouver, the last 25 years, that I found fascinating is sort of how our buildings look. Say if you go down Canby Street from, I guess, 16th to King Edward, you see apartments there, and they're sort of, I guess, what, four or five stories high?
Yeah, maybe more, three to four of those ones are, you know, 1940s, 1950s.
Buildings. Yeah, and we have apartments that look like that throughout the city. And then, of course, you talk about the Vancouver Special, which is a house that, I guess, is, what, two stories high with no basement?
Yeah, Vancouver's modest contribution to world architecture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So are these sorts of things, are these unique to Vancouver?
No, the Vancouver Special is turning out to be quite an extraordinary resource of if I call it affordable housing, I mean, you can laugh at that because they aren't really affordable. But what they are is they're built and they're big, and they offer an incredible amount of flexible space for people in the future for different configurations of families and all the rest of it. And if we're smart, we will do everything that we can to keep them rather than tearing them down and building new things that will inevitably be that much more expensive and that much less affordable. But as for the apartment buildings, I think, along Canby and South Granville and Marpole, and as you're saying, goes out into Burnaby and New Westminster and the rest, these are the kind of walk-up apartments, three-story walk-up apartments built in the 1940s and 50s. They're great accommodation. As long as you don't have people wearing high heels on the hardwood floor above you, they can be quite quiet and quite reasonable. And because they're built, and as long as they're maintained, they can continue to provide affordable rental housing. And the city does have its rental replacement policy in, which is a very, very good one, which says that if a developer tears down anything more than six units in a building, it has to replace that with rental housing. And, so there is a kind of a move to keep those sorts of buildings going. But they're part of the fabric. These buildings for 60 years and more have been providing a lot of people with some very, very good rental housing in the city. A lot of them aren't pretty. You only see some really pretty ones around the South Granville area from the 1920s and 1930s. But a lot of them are kind of utilitarian. But in terms of housing a lot of people in a medium density way, they're really great.
Dwellings in the city, say if you're renting apartments or condos, they have gotten smaller, haven't they?
Well, they certainly have. The ones we were just talking about, the 10-suite walk-up, those three-story walk-up buildings, they typically would be probably 700 square feet, 750 square feet for a one-bedroom. In the 1960s and 70s, the apartments that were going in that people will also recognize, I mean, here and everywhere, those kind of horizontal strip apartments with balconies out. Every apartment had a balcony in them. They were smaller, down about 650 square feet, and now, of course, particularly in the high rises, just beginning in the 1960s with the high rises. You get 400s, 300s, and then you hear of these micro suites that people are buying, people are renting, and everything. But it's just how people are living. One of the things in the book, I've got a floor plan in it of a 1909 apartment building in the West End that is a terrific little studio suite, 375 square feet with a bed that rolls out of a closet. The Holmes Disappearing Bed Company was the company that made it. And I mean, it's just this lovely little apartment in a building that is 102 years old. And so the idea of living small and living compact in an urban setting is not unique to modern Vancouver.
Yeah, how do you see the city changing? How do you think it'll look 5-10 years down the road? Are you hopeful?
I think there are real fights going on about this, you know, this sort of densification initiative going into areas that, that where the residents feel that the areas are working really well. Now, that includes high-density areas like the West End and lower-density areas like the inner ring of the Grandview, Mount Pleasant, Kitsilano, those old kind of streetcar suburbs there, where people live and they've invested in houses, they've invested in condos, and they really like the way the place is working. But the city is determined to add more people living in there, although they don't seem to be able to figure out how to add more transit or to deal with the congestion issues of that type of thing. I think another fight that may well come up would be in the really lower density parts of Vancouver, the you know, the Kerrisdales and the South Vancouver's, where the lots are bigger and you get these great big single family houses, a lot of which are only maybe 15, 20 years old, the monster house type of thing. If anything changes in terms of the economy, these places are just primed to be converted into rooming houses, in my opinion. I think there, you know, I can imagine the similarity between those great big houses now and the great big houses in the West End in 1914, 100 years ago. The middle class had begun to leave the West End 100 years ago, and it left behind all these big houses, and they were converted into rooming houses, and I could see exactly the same thing happening. And, you know, whether that will cause a big fight there or whether it will just be a gradual transition into them being a higher density area, I'm not sure. But I think in terms of what can continue, I don't see how housing prices can continue as high as they are, because I don't see how interest rates can continue to be as low as they are. And at some point, that will be the straw that will break the camel's back, and I think there will be a real, you know, a real stall and a fallback in the price of housing here, much as there was in the early 1980s. There was a real recession in the early 1980s based on real estate collapse in the city.
Other than flogging this book, what's next for you, Michael?
You know, I am really not totally sure. I'm contemplating a graphic novel, which I am delaying doing because it requires a huge computer upgrade that I'm wondering, you know, you never know when you buy a computer whether you're going to buy last year's model or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, painting and otherwise, and being involved with some of the groups that I support in the city, the Heritage Vancouver Society, the Heritage Foundation, the Archives, these sorts of groups.
You've done a marvelous service with this book and your previous books. These are books that we'll be reading for years to come. It's been such a pleasure talking today. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Well, thanks for calling. It was great talking to you.
The website for more, michaelkluckner.com. The book is called Vanishing Vancouver, The Last 25 Years. People really should go out and buy this book. It's a handsome book, and it's informative, and it's thought-provoking at the same time. Whitecap is its publisher, its author. Michael Kluckner on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunder.